It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this month, Wisconsin saw its first reported measles transmission this year after Texas saw a surge in cases back in the spring.
State health officials have reported that at least 21 people in Oconto County in northeast Wisconsin have been infected with measles.
The disease is highly contagious, so its emergence in Wisconsin is raising some alarm bells for public health officials.
The rise in cases also comes as kids are heading back to school, and the state has lower than average rates of vaccinations for children.
Stephanie Schauer is the immunization program manager at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've got the state's case map open. I'm looking at Oconto County with 21 cases now. What do we know about the latest on measles here in the state this month?
Yeah, so unfortunately, Wisconsin has joined 42 other jurisdictions in reporting measles in 2025. You know, nationally, there's been over 1,400 cases, and now Wisconsin has joined that. Some of the initial cases were due to out-of-state travel, with some of the additional cases really due to exposures within Wisconsin. And so we're working very closely with local public health departments and healthcare providers to do all that we can to really contain the spread of measles.
Also on that map, 21 cases I mentioned, 21 unvaccinated people. Can you talk about how contagious measles is for people who are not vaccinated?
Yeah, so measles is one of the most infectious diseases that we have. If you have a group of 10 individuals who are exposed to someone with measles and none of those 10 are protected, we expect 9 of them to come down with measles. The other thing about the virus is that it can remain suspended in the air for up to 2 hours. So if someone with measles is in an indoor space and they leave and someone who is susceptible walks in within that 2 hours after that person leaves, they can contract the disease. So you don't even need face-to-face contact to come down with measles if you are susceptible.
The incubation period from exposure to symptoms, I'm looking at, 10 days, 2 weeks in that neighborhood. Does that make it hard to track the spread of the disease if I'm exposed today? I won't know I have it till well into September.
Yeah, that's true. And often people don't recognize that they have measles because it starts with symptoms that may be confused with others, such as a runny nose, a cough, red watery eyes, a fever that starts to increase. And it's when the rash comes out, and that can be up to 4 days after you've started these symptoms, that rash, which is very characteristic of measles, sort of the light bulbs go off and say, oh, this might be measles. And at that point, someone's been infectious for the previous 4 days and will continue to be infectious for another 4 days. So individuals with measles are infectious for a total of 9 days, which is a long time and can result in exposures that were unintended.
Looking at local preparedness, back in the spring, we talked to Melissa Geach from the Iron County Health Department. They're well to the northwest of where we've seen these cases. Here's what she had to say.
Well, in our small community, measles outbreak could be difficult, as you know, it would be an all hands on deck effort with our small staff here.
This is when we were watching from the outside as this was going on elsewhere in the country. Now it's here. What kind of things, Stephanie, are you seeing from local health departments as they watch what's happening in Oconto County and get ready for exposure in their communities?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're trying to support the local public health and healthcare systems by making sure that providers are aware of the situation, that they know what to do if a patient calls and says, I may have been exposed or I think I have measles, that they can prepare the sites so that when someone comes in, that person can be safely evaluated and that others aren't being exposed. So it is so important that if someone thinks they have been exposed to measles or may have measles, to call ahead to their healthcare provider so that we can prevent additional exposures. We're certainly also working to ensure that we get laboratory testing and that we know and can confirm if it's measles or if it's some other diseases. And so, and then lastly, you know, providing education out to folks about what measles is and the importance of vaccination. The measles vaccine is very safe and very effective. This is a vaccine that has been used for over 50 years, This is a vaccine that I received in my teens, that my kids who are now in their 20s received when they were little, and that children are receiving today. So it has a long track record. It's also been shown that it has greatly reduced the number of measles cases, and over 575 million doses of these vaccines have been used worldwide. So this is a key part of preventing and reducing spread of measles, is making sure everyone in our community is protected.
Stephanie Showers with us, immunization program manager at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, looking at measles, some detected now in Oconto County. Stephanie, back to school season is here. Wisconsin ranks low in the country when it comes to that childhood vaccination rate. So when you look at the number of kids going into kindergarten who have had those recommended two doses, how much does that worry you that we have this lower than average vaccination rate? Measles is here. Kids go back to school.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And when we look at overall rates, we saw about a 3% decrease from the previous year. We certainly have pockets throughout the state that have lower than needed rates. We have counties, you know, at 44% up to 88%. And with measles, you need about 95% of a community protected in order to reduce the opportunity for measles to spread. And so I think, you know, we continue to share information with local public health and healthcare providers and remind them that it's so important to assess folks as they're coming in for routine healthcare and make sure that they are protected. And talking about parents and reminding them that that annual, you know, visit with their clinician is such a key part, because they will assess to make sure that they are up to date. Alternately, parents can check the Wisconsin immunization record, or the WIR system, and look at their child's immunization records to make sure that they have everything they need. But certainly if there's questions, contacting their local healthcare provider or local tribal health department or even pharmacists, they do vaccinate, and they can help you determine if your child or if you need any of the vaccines.
One thing that struck me, Stephanie, one of the measles patients in Wisconsin is 7 months old. Now, that's before vaccines are routinely recommended. What should parents of infants under 12 months old know about protecting their child against this outbreak?
Yeah, the MMR vaccine is recommended to be given. The first dose is at 12 to 15 months, and then the second dose is 4 to 6 years of age, or usually kindergarten entry. And so it is really a tough place that we don't currently have a mechanism of actively protecting those young infants. And so with vaccination. So what we would say is the next best thing is making sure that everyone around that infant is protected. So ensuring, you know, the family members and childcare providers and all are protected. The other thing, too, is if folks are traveling, is you can check the CDC website, particularly overseas. There are places where measles is really circulating. And some parents may need to make some hard decisions about whether you would want to take a young child into a place where measles cases are commonly occurring. We know measles is such a serious disease, particularly for children under five who are not protected. And so it is difficult, but I think starting with those around that infant and doing the best you can to protect that way.
I want to talk about the seriousness of the disease. We had almost gotten rid of measles with vaccines. It was very uncommon for a while there. And people might think back, well, back in the day, we all got measles. I had it. I survived, they might say. But it can have really serious consequences, right?
It did. You know, in the pre-vaccine era in 1963, and this is the year that the measles vaccine was licensed, so not widely in use yet, Wisconsin alone had over 68,000 measles cases and 19 deaths. And if you look at the current outbreak today, there's been over 1,400 cases, and this is national data, is over 1,400 cases and 3 deaths. And we know that 30% of cases have a complication like diarrhea or ear infections. This is more common in those less than 5. And we know that for children less than five years of age, 1 in 5 who get measles are hospitalized. This is not a benign disease that sort of comes and goes. The other piece is that there's the sort of the newly appreciated impact of measles disease called immune amnesia. And this is where the body is not able to respond as well to germs that it was already immune to. And they're seeing this in the months after illness, and there's some studies showing that it can have a lasting impact up to 3 years. So not only do you have the issues related to the acute illness, but you also have this impact on the individual's ability to fight off other diseases that they were perhaps already doing just fine fighting off.
As we wrap up, Stephanie, if people in their homes, in their families, see signs, they think, hey, this looks like the measles description you just gave, what do they do? Who do they call? Who do they notify?
Yep. Call your healthcare provider. They can go ahead and provide counsel and figure out a safe way to go ahead and have you evaluated and determine if it truly is measles. That's such a key part of this piece. And I would say, you know, also if they're, for folks who are concerned, really check your vaccination records, make sure you're protected. If you're over or born before 1957, you're generally considered immune. Most adults need one dose, and generally kids are recommended to receive two doses of the MMR vaccine.
Stephanie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Stephanie Schauer, Immunization Program Manager at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. We've been talking about measles in Wisconsin and how public health officials are responding as we go into a new school year. Want to hear from you. Do you have your eye out for this? Do you have a memory of measles yourself or in your family as a kid? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, in recent months, former UW women's athletes have talked publicly about their mental health struggles relating to what they described as toxic coaching environments. Hear from a former UW cross-country runner.
I was just in a constant state of fear. Like every day I was just fighting for my life to keep my spot on the racing team.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In 2022, the head coach of the UW-Madison women's cross-country team resigned after about 2.5 years on the job.
In recent months, five former athletes who competed under Mackenzie Wartenberger came forward with allegations that her leadership fragmented the team and created a toxic environment, causing mental health struggles. The athletes brought up patterns of emotional abuse, body shaming, and dismissing injury concerns.
Now, similar allegations are surfacing in UW women's basketball. This month, five former players brought a suit against their former coach, Marissa Mosley, and other UW administrators, claiming they were subject to psychological abuse, retaliation, and discrimination.
One of the former cross-country runners joins us now, and as a warning, this conversation has mentions of suicide. Lexley Westley ran for the Badgers from 2019 to 2024. She holds a master's degree in sports leadership from UW-Madison and is now an assistant coach of the men's and women's cross-country teams at Rutgers University. Lexi, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. Again, I really appreciate you reaching out and this opportunity. And I'm just really, really grateful for this.
Can you describe your passion for running and for being an elite athlete? Can you take us into this world?
Yeah. I mean, I come from a long line of athletes and coaches. So the passion around women's sports, men's sports, everything was there. And, you know, I grew up a soccer player and then I found my way into running and running quickly became my world and my everything. And I have such a deep love for this sport. And ultimately, you know, what I've gone through in my life, my career, and a lot of this experience shaped me into my dream of wanting to become a college coach and just learn what I used at Wisconsin and in my life to, you know, this program here.
Can you describe your experience as a student athlete at Wisconsin?
Wisconsin really gave me the greatest 5 years of my life. I couldn't be more thankful for the friends I made, the experiences. Like, these are the memories I'm going to have forever, and it makes me emotional when I think about my time. Obviously, I had a lot of ups and downs through the coaching experiences, you know, loss of a teammate and a friend. But I had the greatest 5 years of my life, and I wouldn't trade my Wisconsin experience for anything.
What compelled you to go on the record and to speak out about your experiences under your previous coach, Mackenzie Wartenberger, who left the university in January 2022?
You know, after going through just mental, verbal, emotional, you know, abuse and just being degraded by your coach for so long, like, you just were in a place of fear. So it took a lot of that confidence building, reflection, therapy, you know, talking with my friends, my family, and now also being in a coaching role. You know, I'm in a position of leadership with 36, 37 athletes that I coach. And it's like, if I can share my story and be vulnerable, you know, I could help one of them or help another athlete or a future recruit. And I knew I needed to, you know, step up and speak out.
Was the coaching and the treatment mostly verbal in nature?
There was a really, really interesting divide on our team in the sense of half of us, you know, roughly half of us were enduring, you know, just fear and horror under Mackenzie's coaching. Again, she was super passionate about coaching, about the sport. But the way that she expressed that probably wasn't the appropriate and correct way to do so. But then the other half of our team, you know, were really just seeing, you know, tough coaching, and they weren't experiencing the constant, you know, yelling, the fear, the panic attacks, the, she would make, you know, she would go after the way I dressed, I'm someone who dresses colorful and I have glitter and sparkles, and she'd go after my character as a person. Made, you know, very nasty verbal remarks about my family and the people that raised me, the character traits that make me who I am and my personality. And that was really hard. You know, as a coach, I'm looking at that now. And I'm like, those are all things that are not what a coach should be, quote, coaching you. Like, those don't have to do with my running. And it was really hard to feel like a woman who's preaching woman empowerment, and you know, I was watching my confidence just crumble under, you know, just before my own eyes, and how I didn't really wear my colorful, you know, shorts, my headbands. I wasn't really acting the same. I'd go home on breaks and, you know, you're leaving I'm getting ready to fly back to Wisconsin and over Christmas break. And, you know, I'm having panic attacks in front of my parents because I didn't want to go back to school.
Were athletes your fellow runners expected to push through pain? And what was that pain like?
Yeah, I had injuries a lot in college. I had multiple stress injuries. But there were women who, you know, voiced and brought up out loud, you know, I have something wrong. Something hurts in my foot, my shin, something, some sort of pain. And were told to keep going, were not believed, you know, were called babies, were called other not great terms and derogatory terms that, you know, maybe a coach shouldn't be calling their athlete when they're bringing up an injury, and were running through injuries and running through pain, you know, body shaming, comments about weight, comments about, you know, again, things that are not appropriate to be bringing up. And at any time, but also in public settings in front of the rest of the women on our team.
I do want to take a breath here and talk about your late teammate, Sarah Scholes, who died by suicide in April of 2022. Not only your teammate, also your roommate and close friend. What was Sarah like?
Sarah was the most outgoing, smart, driven young woman, like, ever. She was so passionate about, you know, voting and voting rights. mental health, women's rights, student athlete rights. She just embodied this, you know, there is a reason why she wanted to go into law. She was just so driven and goal oriented, but she also had this wild child side. And that's something that we all loved. She was always, you know, she'd always say like, we have to do it for the plot. That big, bold laugh that she had. And, you know, she was just a California girl at heart. We'd always joke of like, you know, we're the two coasters, like the West Coast, East Coast girls like meet.
How did competing as a student athlete, how might that have affected Sarah?
Yeah. The pressures, again, of being at a, you know, Division I, Big Ten, you know, now it's Power Four school, university, just naturally brings stress just with the nature of what we're doing. Also, you know, being a scholarship athlete, you know, the expectations that were on our backs and of performing immediately when we came in, you know, it's something Sarah and I bonded over when we came in as freshmen, of just being scholarship athletes. We were told, you know, you are expected to score. You are expected to be in our top five as a freshman. You know, you are worth X amount of dollars to us. Like, if you are not, you know, you are, quote, useless. You know, we're also just young women in society. Like, there's just pressures to look a certain way, act a certain way, you know, and just uphold these standards of what society has for us. And I think a lot of that, combined with Sarah did have struggles coming into college with mental health, it was that storm that unfortunately led to, you know, a split moment, back in April.
Did you have access to a sports psychologist through the UW or a team mental health professional to talk through some of these issues?
Our team was actually assigned a mental health like liaison who worked directly with UW, but she often came in and worked with team on like visualization and mindfulness. But I also met with her about biweekly. But in the beginning, it was hard to get appointments. I felt like I had to, you know, cancel appointments because I had practice or I had a class or I had something, you know, an optional X, whatever it was, XYZ, you know, thing for the sport. And I had to miss, you know, my meetings, which those were important to me. You know, at the time they were helping me through really dark moments. And it's like I was having to skip, or I felt like I had to skip because I had to be at an obligation.
But shouldn't there have been some red flags for these psychologists as they were listening to these stories?
There could have just been, I think, a little bit more watch for us. Again, there's no handbook for how to handle these things. Like, I get that. But it is really hard, like, thinking back and being like, how did nobody notice? Or like, what we were saying, like, how did that not get brought up to hire, like, quicker?
How do you feel about how the UW responded to reports of abuse from you and your teammates?
Yeah, it's tough because we really didn't come out with I didn't come out with my story until this year. Them not really saying a lot when we were first, you know, while we were in school was, you know, maybe not surprising. But then now after us coming out and saying our story, what was happening, and then kind of declining to respond, like, I get it's a very, you know, again, no rule book handbook for how to handle this, but it felt like we were not taken care of, or like there hasn't been a lot of change post. And that's just a little bit frustrating and disappointing. We're trying to help and make this university and the athletic department the best, you know, in the country. And just trying to help somebody. You never know who could be helped.
Lexi, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much again and for, you know, listening and wanting to have this conversation, spread awareness again about mental health. And, you know, I'm also just really, really proud of myself for speaking up about this and hopefully encouraging and empowering the next generation of student athletes.
That is Lexi Westley. She competed for the UW Badgers women's cross country team from 2019 to 2024. She is speaking out about her experiences that she described as a toxic team culture under the previous coach. Westley is now an assistant coach of the men's and women's cross-country teams at Rutgers University. For a look at broader patterns of mental health and toxic team environments in college sports and the liability in cases like these, we're joined by Nellie Drew. She's a professor of practice in sports law at the University at Buffalo and director of its Center for the Advancement of Sport. Nellie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much.
We just heard from one of five former athletes speaking out about toxic culture on the UW women's cross country team. We now have seen five former UW women's basketball players suing Wisconsin for a situation that has parallels. What might these situations say about the climate within the athletic department?
These situations occur when you have an imbalance of power. Of leverage, right? So Lexi mentioned the fact that she was afraid all the time, that they were running scared literally because of the concern that they're going to lose their spot on the team or potentially, I suppose, your scholarship. And that element permeates the complaint as well. And it's a function of the leverage the coaches have over student athletes, which, as she alluded to, it started to shift a bit, right, with the evolution of the transfer portal and NIL, we're starting to see that counterweight come back up a little bit. So the athletes aren't in quite the same position as they may have been during the period of time when this occurred. And I'm sure, in fact, I actually know that the university did have, you know, policies and procedures in place. But the challenge with those policies and procedures, first of all, was that they did not provide much of a roadmap to go around the people in the department who were the problem. And in addition to that, even if it's a really good policy or procedure, it still depends upon people holding other people accountable. And so the sense I'm getting is that in this athletic department, the coaches were allowed to pretty much do what they wanted to do, and nobody was going to stop them. And that's not a healthy environment.
How should a D1 university respond to allegations like this when they first arise, even informally?
Well, one would hope there'd be a thorough investigation. And they kept getting assurances that they were going to be looking into it or something along those lines, but those things never actually transpired. And you had parents going in and meeting with the athletic department officials, and that didn't get anywhere. So I really wonder what the culture of accountability was at the highest levels inside the athletic department.
D1 athletes at the UW, they do have access to a sports psychologist. Some former psychologists declined to talk with us about the situation. Why might that access not work or not help these women if they were seeking counseling?
One of the things that troubled me the most about this situation is that in the complaint, there are allegations made that one young lady was taken off of her ADHD medications and in the course of 1 year prescribed 11 different drugs. That's mind-boggling. And yes, I really don't understand what the communication process was between the mental health professionals and the athletic department administration. And of course, one of the concerns that's laid out in the complaint is that the women's basketball coach was basically insisting that her players share with her information that should be protected, health information about their mental health treatment in particular.
Can you tell us what you've seen around the country or how this plays into a larger issue?
We see it annually in at least one institution and sometimes really awful consequences, as has happened here, right? It's a question, as I said, of accountability. It's a question of recognizing that any time you have a situation where a lot of people are going to be interacting on a regular basis in stressful situations, that there's going to be the potential for some kind of bad conduct to occur. And oftentimes it's not even intentional. The problem is that when a misstep occurs and it's not corrected, then people start to let more things slide. And that's where you get to a point where behavior like this, where you have a coach, you know, the basketball coach in particular, was calling players in on a daily basis and players leaving her office in tears on every single day. Somebody should have recognized in that department that something was wrong.
You mentioned name, image, and likeness and the transfer portal that might be changing the stakes for athletes and their ability to have some leverage. What do you see happening on that front more recently?
Well, as you probably know, the transfer portal has been incredibly active. It gives athletes an avenue out, an exit ramp. If a coach comes in who is not a coach that they can have a good relationship with, or in an environment that they don't feel positive or can feel like they can be successful in. So that's a huge help. And I know college coaches really don't care for it because it makes their job very, very hard. They're recruiting constantly. But having said that, it does give a sense of agency to the athletes, and certainly the name, image, and likeness does as well.
Can universities, D1 universities, change their culture over time? And if so, how long does that take? Is it mean just a coaching switch, or is it something more entrenched that has to change?
I would suspect the latter, because, again, it's no coincidence that you had two coaches in two different sports accused of similar behavior. That speaks to a larger issue. So whoever hired them, whoever was supervising them, who was responsible for their behavior, certainly either wasn't paying attention or was deliberately, as a complaint alleges, indifferent to it.
Nellie, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Nellie Drew is a professor of practice and sports law at the University at Buffalo and director of its Center for the Advancement of Sport. She joined us for a look at patterns of mental health and toxic team environments in college sports. Earlier, we heard from Lexi Westley, who competed for the UW women's cross country team and is now an assistant coach at Rutgers University.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a UW-Madison student launches a new organization on campus for students from Afghanistan.
I feel like it's more comfortable when you see people like you around you, people who share same culture, same heritage, same values, speak the same language.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a listener's why Wisconsin question about a particular type of toilet.
The toilet has been a common fixture in American homes since the early 20th century. That's when it went from being a feature in wealthy people's homes to a public health necessity for everyone. As people began to install toilets in more pre-World War II working-class homes, some put in basement toilets that stick out like a sore thumb. They often lack privacy and can be in odd locations, like at the foot of the stairs. These curiosities led a WPR listener to reach out to our Wisconsin project. Jessica Hopp of Madison asked, why do so many older homes in Wisconsin have an exposed toilet sitting in the unfinished basement? What's the story behind the Midwestern toilet?
We saw a lot of really old Wisconsin homes over the course of the next year. And the first time we walked into an unfinished basement and saw the lone solo toilet just there with no walls around it, we laughed so hard. We'd never seen anything like that before.
Hopp wound up buying a home built in 1906. And as you can probably guess, it has a basement toilet.
Put on my shoes here. Okay, down the steep, dangerous stairs we go. As a physical therapist, these stairs give me nightmares. So I'm standing in the stairway, right? And so I'm going to turn and show you this is the first thing you see down the stairs. Yeah. And there's the toilet right next to the tool bench.
An article published in 2022 explored Milwaukee's basement toilet phenomenon, suggesting there are reasons for their strange placements.
This is Bobby Tanzillo. I'm the senior editor and senior writer at onmilwaukee.com.
Danzillo says his research turned up different explanations for why the basement toilets came to exist in many older working class homes.
One of the reasons for this toilet is that it's not the one that people like to think about, but it's the one that seems to probably be the real origin of this. Before there were floor drains, they wanted to have a basement receptacle where if water were to back up from the sewer, it would not back up into your house, it would back up into the basement.
Tanzillo also found that the basement was an affordable space to install plumbing, leading to the home's first toilet. It was also a place where someone could go after work to get cleaned up. There are occasionally showers near the basement toilet. Tanzillo says the basement toilets are not unique to Milwaukee or even the Midwest. In fact, they're often referred to as Pittsburgh potties because of their prevalence in western Pennsylvania.
UW-Milwaukee architecture professor emeritus Thomas Hubka says the toilets exist in homes across the country, but are more prevalent in the East and Midwest since they are more likely to have a basement. He says basement toilets built before World War II in Wisconsin likely exist in more urban areas.
In rural Wisconsin, there are going to be few basement toilets like this. It's not one of the things that is part of the ethos of farm life in some ways, going into the basement to clean up or something like that. That's half the state. In 1900, half the state of Wisconsin is farms. So within the urban small town context, here we have the basement toilet.
The Madison home Jessica Hopp lives in has an exposed toilet near the foot of the basement stairs.
I thought it was a little silly, but as this is a one bathroom home and we have a teenager who often has a gaggle of other teenagers over, having a second toilet is delightful. So people end up using it all the time.
This story on basement toilets was written and produced by WPR's John Davis of La Crosse. And this is a bit of a full circle moment. John edited my first radio feature years ago as a college student, and now I have the honor of editing his final story. After a long, distinguished career in journalism, John is retiring from Wisconsin Public Radio. He served as a reporter, producer, and newsmaker's talk show host out of La Crosse for nearly 40 years. During that time, he held those in power accountable and shined a light on the innovative and inspiring things happening in Southwest Wisconsin. John, thank you so much for your work, friendship, and mentorship through these years. We'll miss you so much. Enjoy retirement, and go Brewers. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
This week marks 4 years since the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan. Now children who grew up in Afghanistan during the war are heading to college in the U.S.
A UW-Madison junior wants to create stronger bonds for Afghan students. Hara Salahi is launching a new student group as president of UW-Madison's Afghan Student Association. Hara, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much.
What moved you to want to create the new Afghan Student Association?
Well, I founded the Afghan Student Association after noticing something important on campus. Many student groups were celebrating their cultures through hosting events that brought people together. But I realized that there wasn't a similar space for Afghans. And that really inspired me to create the Afghan Student Association, a community where Afghan students could connect and celebrate their heritage, while also welcoming non-Afghans who are curious to learn, engage, and share in Afghan culture.
So when you start meeting as a group, how will it feel? What will the discussions be like? And what will this group do?
So we are planning a bunch of events for this semester. And for the first event, we are planning on doing a fall kickoff, which we're going to have Afghan traditional food, and we're going to introduce the org to the campus. So basically, we're going to have an introduction talking about Afghani culture, our history, and we're just going to have people learn more about Afghanistan, and also we're going to have play a Kahoot and see how people learn about it and how people liked it.
What food do you hope to serve?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm kind of getting hungry. But yeah.
<Me too. laughs>
Well, one of the very popular food that we have is called kabli palau. It's rice with lamb and raisins and carrots. It's really popular and it's really delicious. So I'm hoping to have that. And I'm hoping to have like a bunch of different food because I want everyone to try some Afghani food. So I'll have some dumplings as well, which called ashak, and as well as some chicken kebab and salad, of course.
How did you learn to make these traditional dishes? Who taught you?
Of course, my mom. She's amazing at cooking. She kind of teach me how to like make these food. I mean, I can't cook as well as her, but she's a pro at it. But I can make some, you know, here and there. But yeah.
How do students from Afghanistan find community on campus? What is that like?
Well, when I came to UW-Madison, I went to other events and saw how people came together. And I was like, there isn't a space for Afghans to, you know, come together. So I wanted to create this student org where they can come and like, you know, see people like them, people who share same cultures, same heritage, same values, speak the same language. I feel like it's more comfortable when you see people like you around you. So I feel like having these events will support these students, you know, especially since most of them are living away from home, from their parents. So it's kind of hard to be alone. But then when you see someone from your own country and you just want to like be around them and spend some time with them. So I feel like emotionally and also just to like have something to practice, somewhere to practice your culture and your, you know, celebrate your heritage, to not forget about it and, you know, see people like them and feel comfortable and connected with campus and feel safe.
I would imagine, too, now as a third year student, you're the one who is helping other Afghan students who are new to campus have those same feelings of community and feeling assured that it will be okay for them.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.
We're learning about a new student organization at UW-Madison, the Afghan Student Association, that will kick off this semester. Third-year undergraduate student Hera Salahi is the group's founder and president. Hera, are there unique challenges of being an international student on campus and having a healthy outlook about the campus environment?
Well, I'm not an international student myself, so mm-hmm. I can't speak to that experience directly, mm-hmm. but I have been following the news and know how difficult things have been. Recently, thousands of student visas were revoked, leaving many students suddenly uncertain about whether they could even remain in the country. This has also placed strain on universities, which rely on international students, not only for financial support, but also for the cultural diversity and richness they bring to campus life. The process of getting student visas is becoming harder and harder, and I know these are some really difficult times, but we can't lose sight of how important these opportunities are and how many people truly need them. All over the world, there are students who dream of studying in the United States who hold on to the hope of continuing their education here. When I think about that need, I like to think about Afghan girls. For the past 4 years, they have been banned from pursuing an education, which is the most basic human right. Imagine being told that you cannot learn, you can't grow, you cannot chase your dreams. And yet, despite all this, Afghan girls continue to hold on to that hope. A hope that one day they will be able to study again, hope that one day that their dream will not be denied. That's why opportunities like student visas matter, because for so many, they're not just paperwork or permission. They are the chance to reclaim a future. So imagine if Afghan girls had the chance to get a student visa and continue their education abroad. That would be a golden opportunity that could completely change their lives. And it's not just them, just like them. There are like a lot of other young people around the world with the same hope. That's why access to student visa and education is not just important, it's necessary.
Are there certain ways that your new student organization could help or support the education of Afghan women?
Well, yes, definitely. That's one of my goals. Since I moved to the United States, I always wanted to support the women and girls back home. One of the goals for my association this year, I am planning on kind of connecting with other Afghan student association and other universities across the United States and coming together, seeing how we can support those women and girls back home.
Do you imagine a day when there will be peace in Afghanistan, when you might be able to return to the country?
That's one of my dreams, to be able to return to my country, to see people in peace and see women being returned back to schools and work and having their own freedom to walk around the city with no fear. It's really painful to be here and watch the news every single morning, seeing there are so many stuff going on in your country and you really can't help them. It is one of my dreams to see my country in peace. And yeah, I would love to return back and, celebrate that peace and everything with my families back home and with my friends and the people of Afghanistan.
What do you look forward to most in this coming school year?
Really looking forward for the events that I'm going to be hosting. I am really excited because I have friends reaching out to me. They're like, we're so excited to come to your events. This is so exciting. So I'm really excited to like host events and have people come and learn more about Afghanistan. And one of the events that I'm really looking forward into is I want to have a discussion event where I talk about the Afghan girl situation and see what everyone thinks about it and see everyone's opinion on it. And that's pretty much it for the association part. But for my academic life, I'm just trying to, you know, catch up with classes and yeah.
Is there a network of Afghan student associations outside of UW-Madison? You mentioned other universities. Is there a wider network of these groups?
Not in Wisconsin, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But we do. I was trying to connect with the University of Minnesota, and there was. They actually started a new Afghan association recently as well, and I kind of wanted to connect with them as well. But yeah, there are a lot of them actually in cities like New York, California. There's like a lot of them that I'm looking forward into connecting with them.
Well, Hera, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us, and all the best to your new student organization and to this year.
Yes, of course. Thank you so much. Yeah.
That is UW-Madison's Hera Salehi.
Later this week, we'll meet two Wisconsin students who won gold medals in the National Skills USA competition.
The program brings together high school students from around the country to compete in workplace skill challenges from industrial design and manufacturing to facilities management.
So here's our question for you today. What's the most valuable piece of job training you've ever gotten, and where'd you get it? Was it in high school, on the job, in an apprenticeship program, technical college, or university? Tell us about it, and we can share your story in a future show.
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Beatrice Lawrence, and Avery Lee Rogers. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.